Shalom, I'm Rabbi Stephen Sacks. Anti-Semitism, Stage 4. Kol Nidre 5779. It's been said that the world's oldest disease is anti-Semitism. But there's something new about this old disease. In fact, this disease has already mutated 3 times and we are now suffering through a 4th mutation. Let's look at the first 3. The rationale for the first mutation of anti-Semitism was displayed by Augustine in the Adversos Judaeos, Against the Jews, and in Book 4 of The City of God, both which were dated to about 425 CE. Now, Augustine believed that the Jews should be allowed to survive, but not thrive. Rather, as he put it, their backs must always be bent downwards. Former Catholic priest James Carroll, in his acclaimed work Constantine's Sword, sums up Augustine's approach as such. The Jews' homelessness and misery are the proper punishment for their refusal to recognize the truth of the claim of the Church. And their misery proves it. Circular logic. Think about it. You make the Jews suffer, and then use their suffering as proof of their guilt. So the Jews were to be allowed to survive, but in a lowly manner, to demonstrate what happens to those who reject the teachings of the Church. While this live but don't let live well attitude was demeaning, it did allow the Jews to exist by requiring an end to assaults against them. The second mutation of anti-Semitism can be dated to the beginning of the Crusades in 1096. Jews were no longer only accused of rejecting Christ, but of poisoning wells and spreading the plague. Tragedy after tragedy ensued as Jews were expelled, forced to live in ghettos, subject to inquisitions and attempts to save their souls, and to murderous pogroms. Now, ironically, the third mutation of anti-Semitism was born during the Enlightenment. In 1879, Wilhelm Marr coined a new term, anti-Semitism. As Rabbi Jonathan Sacks explains, the fact that a new name was needed signals a change from the past. No longer would a rational prejudice be based on the sacred text of Christianity. It was therefore relocated from religion to race. Jews weren't hated because of their beliefs, but because of their ethnicity. Thus, racial anti-Semitism was born, and the change to racial anti-Semitism was literally deadly. After all, you could change your religion, but you can't change your race. And we all know too well that this new form of anti-Semitism culminated in the Shoah, the Holocaust, wiping out 1/3 of world Jewry. Now, for a time, guilt over the Holocaust made it politically incorrect to be openly anti-Semitic in Europe, and even today, many people don't want to acknowledge they're practicing a form of bigotry. Well, unfortunately, these anti-Semites have found a way to have their treif cake and eat it too. Instead of engaging in overt anti-Semitism, they now engage in anti-Israelism, as Melanie Phillips refers to it in commentary. This is the fourth and current mutation of anti-Semitism. As Phillips explains, anti-Israelism has exactly the same characteristics that make traditional anti-Semitism a unique derangement. Both are based entirely on falsehoods and malicious distortions. Both single out Israel and the Jews for a double standard and treatment afforded to no other nation. Both accuse Israel of the Jewish people of crimes of which they're not only innocent of, but they are in fact the victims of. Both dehumanize Israel or the Jewish people. Both attribute to Israel or the Jewish people demonic global conspiratorial power. And both are utterly beyond reason. However, this treatment of Israel is justified as mere criticism of its behavior. It's not criticism. As Phillips puts it, criticism is rational. This is irrational and malicious demonization of Israel and Zionism. This anti-Zionism singles out the Jewish people alone for the destruction of their nationhood. And if Israel were to abide by the double standards that its critics wanted to, the Jewish state would lose the ability to defend itself and cease to exist. Phillips compares making sense of this new anti-Semitism to peeling a rotten onion. As you peel it, it just gets worse and worse as you go deeper. It's based on the Marxist view that everything must be understood in terms of political power. The world is divided into the powerful and the powerless. Those with power can never be good. Those without power can never be bad. Those who make money have power over those who don't make money. Those who make money are bad. Those without money are good. Jews make money. Therefore, Jews are powerful and bad. And Israel's power only reinforces the stereotype. The fact that Israel only equips itself with such might out of sheer necessity for the purpose of national survival doesn't factor in for these neo-anti-Semites. Rather, it breathes life into the paranoid delusion that the Jews are so powerful that they actually pose a threat to everybody else. The next layer of the onion is even worse. Phillips explains that the West will never forgive the Jews for the Holocaust. Let me say that again. The West will never forgive the Jews for the Holocaust. And it's not because of guilt. It's because of jealousy. Jealousy. Phillips can't be seriously suggesting that people are jealous of the suffering the Jews endured during the Holocaust, can she? Before dismissing her claims, listen to her explanation. The Holocaust gives the Jews what many in the West perceive as a trump card of victimhood. Phillips relates, "I've often heard the Jews accused of sucking up all of the victimhood in the world and leaving no room for anyone else to claim to be a victim." What does this nonsensical claim mean? Only that the enormity of the crime against the Jews was so vast that people think that any victim status claimed by anyone else is rendered minor in comparison and thus devaluated. But that begs the question, why would anyone want to be considered a victim in the first place? Phillips explains, it's because victimization gives them a moral free pass. The belief is, if you're a victim, you can't be held responsible for your own misdeeds. You can never be a victimizer. It's this type of misguided logic which allows people to view terrorists as freedom fighters and heroes. Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of Britain's Labour Party, and possibly the next Prime Minister of Great Britain, went so far as to refer to Hamas and Hezbollah as friends, and invited them to Parliament in 2009. To what lengths will people go to attain this prize victim status? During the week of Holocaust Memorial Day, PATV misrepresented a photograph of concentration camp victims as Arabs, claiming that Jews burned Arabs in Nazi ovens. The big lie that underlines the claim of the fourth mutation of anti-Semitism is that Jews have obtained the power they so abuse by skillfully playing the victim card. However, this claim runs contrary to Jewish values and history. As B'nai Yisrael, the children of Israel, found themselves with their backs to the sea of the Egyptian army bearing down on them, they began to panic. Moses reassured them, saying there was nothing to worry about. He told the people, God will make war for you, and you shall remain silent. But God responded to Moshe, saying, Moshe, ma tzatzakalai, why are you crying out to me? God is saying to Moshe, Mo, don't passively play the role of victim and expect me to take care of you and your problems. Take charge of the situation. Raise up your staff and split the sea and have B'nai Yisrael go forward. Only after Moses and the people stopped viewing themselves as victims and showed their willingness to venture forward did God intervene. First by moving his angel and the cloud which had been leading the people to the back to create a barrier between the people and their pursuers. And secondly, by splitting the sea. Yes, God worked a miracle to save his people, but only after the people took the initiative. The Talmud actually cautions us not to rely on miracles. Rather, we must take the initiative as our ancestors did. Though we feel secure in the United States, and God bless America, it's a wonderful country, we must not forget that the fourth mutation of anti-Semitism is now propelling an exodus of Jews from Europe to Israel, and it's a stark reminder of the importance of maintaining a Jewish state. Now, being that we don't rely on miracles, what can we do to ensure the survival of the state of Israel? Since we're fighting the world's oldest disease, anti-Semitism, and someone mentioned to me I look like a doctor wearing this white robe here, I'm going to prescribe 3 courses of action. Prescription 1, be informed and speak up. Don't get all of your news from one source. On May 15th, the New York Times published an article claiming that Israel had killed 60 protesters at Gaza's border the previous day. This despite the fact that the New York Times itself reported the Israeli army claimed 11 of the dead were armed Hamas members in civilian attire, engaging in activities such as throwing grenades at Israeli soldiers. But if at least 11 of those killed were reportedly armed fighters engaged in hostilities, why did subsequent New York Times pieces claim that 60 protesters were killed that day? When CAMRA, the Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting in America, asked about this apparent misuse of language, the Times insisted that its reporting on the events is accurate. When asked to clarify whether that means its reporters concluded, contrary to Israeli assertion, that none of the 60 killed were in fact engaged in violence, or if not, whether it means the newspaper feels comfortable describing armed militants among the 60 dead as protesters, editors declined to comment. My comment is, how very disappointing. How very disappointing that the paper of record wouldn't clarify the record. By the way, 2 days after the event, Hamas bragged that 50 of those killed were members of its organization. So much for claims it was a peaceful protest. So when you hear people citing inaccurate information, and often they do it innocently, don't remain silent like a passive victim. Look at the situation as a teachable moment and share with them the reality of the situation. Prescription 2, speak up in an organized fashion. One of the reasons we come together to make our petitions before God is because we believe there is strength in numbers. The same applies to politics. When we come together, our voice becomes louder. Get involved in groups that advocate on behalf of Israel, and please, please, please strongly consider joining our delegation in March at the AIPAC Policy Conference in Washington. Our lobbying sessions give you the opportunity to join together with your fellow Delawareans and Pennsylvanians in an effort to affect U.S. policy. And it's not just a feel-good opportunity. Your presence really does make a difference. The Prime Minister of Israel wouldn't appear year after year at AIPAC if he didn't feel that our efforts were of true value to Israel. And prescription 3, join us in Israel. History has taught us that the best antidote to the world's oldest disease is a Jewish state. And there is no better way to show your support for that state than by going there. So as I stand here before you tonight in Kol Nidre, my final prescription for you is to take a trip to Israel. And the good news is, you don't have to go alone. Rabbi Beals and I are leading a trip this coming June. Step forward and join us. Yisrael Chayim.